You can have it all. Great pay, awesome benefits, a flexible schedule, the chance to grow. At Cox, we're recruiting auto and diesel technicians to join our Manheim and Fleet Services teams. If you're ready for a new job and want to experience an award-winning workplace, drive your career forward with us. Visit cox.career/autotech to learn more. That's cox.career/autotech.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever find yourself playing the budgeting game? Well, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive, you can find options that fit your budget and potentially lower your bills. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law. Not available in all states.
This is an ad by Regain Couples Therapy. Let's be honest. Loving your partner doesn't mean you always like them. And guess what? That's normal. Regain offers couples therapy that's flexible, affordable, and 100% online. Whether you're reconnecting or working through conflict, Regain is here to support you both. See why people wish they'd try couples therapy sooner. Visit regain.com/couplespod to get 10% off your first month. That's regain.com/couplespod.
Welcome back to Mama Mystery. I am your host, Kelly, and thank you so much for joining me today. Today, we're diving into the case of Patty Pruitt, and this is a case of love, loss, and a decades-long fight for justice. It's a story that starts with a picture-perfect family and ends with a 75-year-old grandmother walking free after nearly 40 years behind bars. We'll walk through the story as it unfolded step by step, so get comfortable and let's go back to where it all began. Patricia, or Patty Pruitt, and her husband Bill seemed to have the kind of life you'd read about in a feel-good novel. They were high school sweethearts from rural Missouri who married young, built a business, and started a big family. Patty was outgoing and witty, the PTA mom who volunteered at school and could chat with anyone. Bill was steady and hardworking, a former teacher turned lumberyard owner who was admired in the community for his honesty and helpful nature. By the early 1980s, the Pruitts were living in the small town of Holden, about 50 miles outside of Kansas City, running a lumber and hardware store together and raising five children. They were active in church and civic life, and Patty was even president of the local Chamber of Commerce, while Bill coached Little League baseball. Friends and neighbors saw them as this all-American couple, hardworking and devoted, but like every real family, behind the smiling photos, there were challenges that outsiders just didn't see. In the mid-1970s, about a decade into their marriage, Patty and Bill faced a trauma that would really test their relationship. In 1974, during a trip to the town of Sedalia, Patty was attacked and raped by a group of men. She was in her mid-20s, a mother of three at the time, and the assault left really deep emotional scars, as you can imagine. But in those days, sexual assault wasn't often talked about, and Patty later said, quote, "There was no counseling in those days. You just kept your mouth shut and worked on it after the kids go to bed," end quote. So Patty and Bill made a fateful decision. They never reported the rape to police, and they told no one. Bill tried to be supportive, but the trauma lingered between them, and in the months that followed, he grew distant, and Patty felt terribly isolated. Their once strong partnership was strained under the weight of an awful secret that they felt they had to hide. During this rough patch in the late 70s, both Patty and Bill strayed outside the marriage. Patty, feeling unloved and desperate for affection, admittedly had several affairs between 1979 and 1982, which was something she would later openly admit. Years afterward, she explained that she felt alone, lonely, and in need of someone to hold her, trying to convey the emotional hole she was in. Bill, for his part, had at least one brief fling of his own around that time, though details of his infidelity were scarcely documented compared to Patty's. It was an incredibly difficult chapter for the couple, and at one point, Patty even became pregnant by another man, a fact that she eventually confessed to Bill. But despite all these hurts, Patty and Bill decided to stay together. They did what they could to patch things up. They went to church, they focused on their kids and the business, and tried to rebuild trust. Patty later said, quote, "We got over it. If you love each other and really want to, then you can," end quote. Insisting that by the early 1980s, she and Bill had reconciled and moved on from the past. By 1984, after nearly 16 years of marriage, the Pruitts were planning for the future, raising their kids, ranging from a teenager down to as young as a kindergartner, and working side by side each day. Life wasn't perfect, but it felt stable and hopeful again. Neither of them could have imagined how suddenly it would all come crashing down. On February 17th of 1984, a Friday, the Pruitt family spent a routine evening at home. Patty made dinner, the kids did their homework, and the parents chatted about the coming weekend. It was an ordinary winter night in Missouri, cold and rainy, with a late winter storm rolling in. By around 11 p.m., the house in Holden was quiet. The children were asleep in their bedrooms. Bill, 35 years old at the time, was exhausted from a long work week, and he had gone to bed. Patty, who was 34 at the time, stayed up a bit later, reading in bed beside him. And at some point, she drifted off as the rain pattered on the roof. Sometime after 2 a.m. in the early morning of February 18th, Patty awoke to a startling sensation. Someone was yanking her hair hard. In the fog of sleep, for a split second, she thought maybe one of the kids was tugging at her, but as she came to, she felt a rush of terror. A strange man was in their dark bedroom, and in a flash, according to Patty, this intruder dragged her out of bed by her hair and threw her violently to the floor, held a knife blade against her throat, and she could not see his face in the darkness and in the chaos. She later recalled in an interview just how disorienting it was. One moment she's asleep next to her husband, and the next she's on the floor being overpowered with a knife on her throat. And she remembers the man tearing at her pajamas. She felt the knife pressed to her neck, and she truly believed she was about to be raped and killed. As this attack was happening, there was utter darkness. Patty realized that the lights had suddenly gone out. In fact, the house's power had been shut off at the breaker box, and even the phone line was dead because someone had cut the cords. The entire home was eerily silent except for the struggle in the bedroom, and in the midst of this, Patty heard what she thought was thunder. There was a storm outside, after all, but she registered two loud bangs, but in her panicked state, they just didn't immediately register as gunshots. Bill, who had been sleeping just a few feet away, didn't scream, didn't leap up. He didn't make a sound. The intruder's assault on Patty was brief but brutal. She was hit and pinned down with a knife at her throat. She would later have bruises along her inner thighs, her hips and legs, and cuts on her neck, evidence of how violent the encounter was. Patty says she was raped in those terrifying moments on the floor, although in the immediate aftermath, she was too shocked and ashamed to tell police that detail. What we do know is that at some point, the assailant suddenly stopped and stood up. Patty was sobbing and screaming hysterically, and oddly, it seemed to annoy the attacker. So in a chilling twist, he decided to leave her alive. Perhaps fearing the noise or simply done with whatever his plan was, the intruder fled the bedroom and then just disappeared into the night. The entire attack lasted only minutes, but for Patty, it felt like an eternity. Shaking and confused, Patty's first thought was to check on Bill. The intruder was gone. The pitch darkness was disorienting, so Patty stumbled through the house and out to their pickup truck parked outside to grab a flashlight. Rain was pouring, wind was whipping around, and she ran back into the house, flicking the flashlight on, and its beam cut through the darkness of this master bedroom, and that is when she saw the blood. Bill was still lying in bed in the exact position he'd been in when they fell asleep, and Patty shone the light on him and saw blood on his head and pillow. He wasn't moving. She tried to shake him, tried to speak to him, but got no response beyond a faint rattling sound as he breathed. Patty's mind raced. She had to get help, but there was no way to call out because the phone was dead. She knew she needed to get her children out of the house right away, not wanting to scare them more than necessary. But she ran to wake her kids and told them that there was a small fire in the house and that they needed to get out. In truth, she didn't know if the attacker might still be lurking somewhere, and fire just seemed like a less frightening excuse to hurry them out. She gathered her four daughters and one son, ages 5 to 16, some of them still groggy, and hurried them out to the family station wagon in their pajamas. The rain was still falling, and there was no time to even grab shoes or coats. Patty, barefoot and injured, started the car and drove through the storm to a neighbor's farmhouse just a little down the road. It was around 3 a.m. when she banged on her neighbor's door, screaming for help. Imagine being those neighbors, awakened by frantic pounding in the dead of night. Outside stood Patty, soaked, crying uncontrollably, with five confused kids standing behind her. She screamed that someone had broken in and hurt Bill. The neighbors brought them in and immediately called the sheriff. And Patty was described as hysterical, understandably, as she tried to convey what had just happened. She believed Bill was gravely hurt, but at that moment she didn't know he was dead. The neighbor, Patricia Gustin, later recalled the scene as just total chaos. Multiple police officers and friends rushing in and out. Everyone was in shock. And as dawn approached on February 18th, Bill Pruitt was found dead in his bed in the quiet Missouri farmhouse, transformed into a crime scene. Law enforcement from Johnson County, Missouri, not to be confused with Johnson County, Kansas, arrived quickly and secured the Pruitt house. When officers walked into the master bedroom, they found a grisly scene. Bill Pruitt had been shot twice in the head at close range while he laid in bed. One bullet entered his right temple, another hit the back of his head. The wound to the back of the head was instantly fatal, likely killing Bill in his sleep before he even knew what was happening. There were no obvious signs of a prolonged struggle in the bedroom. Bill hadn't even had a chance to get up. Blood was pooled on the pillow and the mattress, and the rest of the house was disheveled from Patty's frantic rush to get the kids out, but not necessarily from a fight. No one except Patty and the children had witnessed anything, and the children, who had been sleeping, hadn't heard the gunshots, possibly because a thunderstorm was raging at the time, masking the sound of the .22-caliber rifle firing. Investigators began combing through the property for evidence, and they noted right away the odd details that Patty had reported. The phone line had been cut, and the electric breaker was shut off, and whoever attacked that night had likely done this to isolate the family. There was no lights, no way to call out for help. And outside, the rain had turned the ground into mud, and about 15 feet from the bank of a pond behind the house, officers found something startling. A rifle submerged in about a foot of water, and it was Bill's own .22-caliber repeater rifle, which he normally kept hidden and unloaded in the bedroom closet for safety. But sometime that night, it had been taken and used to shoot Bill, then tossed in the pond. Near the edge of that pond, in the mud, an officer spotted a single boot print. It was a partial impression, but the tread appeared to match a pair of boots belonging to Patty. A second footprint was later found on the bottom of the pond when they drained it, also seemingly matching Patty's boot. And this would later become one of the most crucial and controversial pieces of evidence in this case. Back in the house, officers took stock of other clues. They found the circuit breaker lever had been indeed switched off, confirming that the intruder had cut the power to the house. But oddly, police did not dust the breaker box for fingerprints, which would seem like a pretty obvious step. If an unknown person pulled the switch, their prints might still be on it. And the cut telephone cords also weren't checked for any fingerprints or tool marks that might identify who sliced them. So these omissions would later be scrutinized as serious investigative missteps. Meanwhile, Patty was taken to the local police station in Holden to give a statement. Keep in mind, this was just hours after she had just been attacked and discovered her husband bleeding. She was in a state of shock. Officers noted that Patty had visible injuries. There were red knife mark cuts on her neck, and the bruises were starting to form on her thighs and hip, consistent with her account of being dragged and assaulted. She was still in her nightclothes, which were muddy and torn at that point. Despite her claim of an unknown intruder, from the very start, the police were eyeing Patty with suspicion. One of the deputies later admitted, in 99% of cases, it's the spouse. And that was the mindset that they approached this crime scene with. In fact, the lead investigator, Johnson County Deputy Sheriff Kevin Hughes, appeared to zero in on Patty almost immediately. While other officers gathered physical evidence, Hughes interviewed Patty that morning. He had her hands swabbed for gunshot residue to see if she had recently fired a gun, and this test done with chemical swabs can detect particles from a firearm discharge on a person's hands or clothes. The results came back negative. There was no trace of gunshot residue on Patty's hands. That would seem to suggest she hadn't fired the rifle that killed Bill, at least not recently enough for residue to linger, because gunshot residue usually dissipates after a few hours or can be washed off. However, this result did little to change the course of the investigation. At the scene, other potential evidence was either overlooked or not properly preserved. One of the Pruitt children, 14-year-old Sarah, told officers something crucial. As she was rushing through the house during the evacuation, she glanced towards the basement door and saw a beam of light shining underneath it, moving around as if someone was in the basement with a flashlight. She even heard a clanging noise, like metal on metal, which she thought might be the sound of heavy basement doors or something in the cellar. Sarah and her brother Matt reported this to Deputy Hughes that very morning, but Hughes dismissed it, later suggesting that Patty had planted this story in her kids' minds. Sarah was adamant, though, then and years later, that she really did see a flashlight's glow and was not just imagining it. Unfortunately, though, police did not thoroughly investigate the basement or treat the flashlight report as a solid lead. No unknown fingerprints were collected from the basement door or windows. It was a hint of a possible intruder's escape route that went nowhere. There were more missed opportunities. Investigators did find two spent shell casings from the .22 caliber rifle, one at the scene and one oddly discovered the next day when an officer sat on a wicker loveseat and a casing fell out. But a neighbor later revealed something disturbing that the jury would never hear. Mary Gustin, the neighbor who comforted Patty that morning, went into the Pruitt house later and said she found a great deal of hair next to the bed, clumps that looked like someone's hair had been pulled out, which would corroborate Patty's story of being grabbed and dragged by her hair. Yet the deputy on scene had earlier noticed some hair on the carpet and decided it wasn't that important. He assumed it was old and didn't collect it as evidence. So by the time Mary pointed it out, it was too late. The hair was never preserved for analysis. Not only that, but there was never any rape kit examination done on Patty that night, even though she had indications of sexual assault. And it's unclear if Patty explicitly told police about the rape at the time. She said apparently attempted rape, but standard procedure would have been to conduct a medical exam, and that just did not happen. Then there were the odd circumstances outside the home. Neighbors reported seeing a strange car near the Pruitt farmhouse that night, parked along a road where it didn't belong, and in a bizarre twist, the Pruitt's normally protective farm dogs were nowhere to be found during this break-in. The family had three dogs that would typically bark at any disturbance. Patty's daughter, Jane, later learned that all three dogs had gone missing that evening, and they were later found dead on a nearby farm, likely poisoned. This suggested someone might have deliberately silenced the dogs earlier in the night as part of this premeditated plan. And if true, it strongly points to an outside perpetrator who prepared for this crime. However, during the investigation, authorities paid little attention to these hints. The focus was rapidly narrowing in on one suspect, Patty herself. By the day after the murder, the direction of the case was clear, at least to the police. Deputy Hughes convened a meeting of the Rural Missouri Major Case Squad on February 19th of 84, and he announced that Patty Pruitt was the prime suspect. In his eyes, the crime scene was staged to look like an intruder had been there, and Patty's story didn't add up. Hughes reportedly told his fellow officers, quote, "Well, the wife's good for it. Couldn't have happened like she says," end quote, and even expressed confidence that they'd have the case wrapped up in a day or two. But why was he so sure? Two reasons emerged, motive and opportunity. Opportunity was simple. Patty was the only other adult in the house alone with the victim, if there was no intruder, as Hughes believed. Then by default, Patty had to be the shooter. As for the motive, investigators quickly dug into the Pruitts' personal lives and found juicy gossip that Patty had cheated on her husband years before. To the predominantly male police squad in 84, this painted Patty as an unfaithful wife who might kill her husband to be with another man or to keep her affairs secret. They also discovered that not long before the murder, Patty had made sure Bill's life insurance premiums were paid up, implying that maybe she stood to gain financially from his death. In their view, Patty had both something to gain and a morally dubious character, which made her a convenient culprit. Over the next few days and weeks, investigators pursued every rumor about Patty's past. It went from a murder investigation to something of a character assassination. Officers were dispatched to interview friends, neighbors, and acquaintances about Patty's relationships with men. They weren't looking for masked intruders. They were looking for evidence that Patty was a bad woman capable of murder. Hughes even compiled second and third-hand stories of Patty's supposed dalliances. And to the police, the intruder scenario was just a smokescreen. Hughes openly scoffed at Patty's claim of sexual assault, implying she might have inflicted her own injuries, something sexual assault experts say is extremely unlikely for a victim to do to herself. They also noted that none of the children heard a stranger or a struggle, although, again, a storm was happening at the time. And the boot print by the pond took on a damning significance. It was Patty's boot. So in the police narrative, that meant she must have waded into the pond to hide the rifle after shooting Bill. Later, it was pointed out that footprint could have been made by her earlier. It was her property, her pond, or even by an officer. But at the time, it was treated as a smoking gun linking Patty to the murder weapon. Now, one more element of motive entered the picture, and it was explosive. While probing Patty's affairs, investigators learned that at least two men who had been romantically involved with Patty claimed that she had approached them in the past about killing her husband. One man, an old flame named Gary, said that Patty once mused about wishing Bill would die in an accident and even mentioned knowing where a gun was if she wanted to shoot him in his sleep. Another former lover, Ricky, the same man with whom Patty had gotten pregnant, initially denied any affair to police, but later told them that Patty had offered him $10,000 to kill Bill, though he admitted he never took her seriously at the time. Then a third man, a younger guy that Patty knew, also alleged that she brought up the idea of murder for hire. Now, these are extremely serious accusations, and they gave prosecutors a clear narrative. Patty didn't just want to cheat on her husband, she plotted to have him killed. Now, it's important to note that some of these witness statements later became highly contested. One of the men, for instance, signed a statement under police pressure and was even promised he wouldn't have to testify if he cooperated. Another, Michael Brown, originally made an allegation but then recanted, saying that Deputy Hughes pushed him not to cooperate with the defense and that in reality, Patty's talk about killing Bill had been a joking exchange that Bill himself heard and laughed off. Ricky Mitz, the man who cited a $10,000 offer, confessed under oath that he had omitted telling police about his own criminal background and that he didn't actually believe Patty was serious when she spoke crudely about her marital problems. However, these nuances would largely get lost by the time of trial. In 1984, what mattered to investigators was that multiple people were willing to say Patty had murder on her mind in the years before Bill's death. And it just cemented their theory that Patty was behind it all and there was no mystery intruder at all. Now, Patty Prewitt was arrested and charged with first-degree murder. Her trial took place in 1985, about a year after Bill's death, in Warrensburg, Missouri. From the outset, it was clear that this trial was not going to center on forensic evidence or eyewitness accounts. There wasn't much of either. Instead, the prosecution made Patty's personal life the centerpiece. They essentially put Patty's character on trial, and it's something we see too often, especially with female defendants. If a woman doesn't fit the expected mold of a perfect wife or mother, that fact alone can be wielded against her as if it proves she's a criminal. Now, in Patty's case, prosecutors hammered away at her past infidelities with a zeal that had spectators' jaws dropping. They introduced evidence of five affairs Patty had over a span of a few years. Now, adultery isn't a crime, but the state painted it as a gateway to murder. During opening statements and throughout the trial, the prosecutor used graphic and judgmental language to describe Patty's behavior. He told the jury that Patty had defiled her marital bed with other men and, quote, abandoned her duties as a mother, accusing her of indulging in one sleazy affair after another while Bill worked hard to provide. The clear intent was to make the jury view Patty as an immoral person and thus more likely to have committed this heinous crime. And this approach played into deep-seated biases, the notion that a woman who is sexually unfaithful is capable of anything, even murdering the father of her children. It's the kind of character assassination that has nothing to do with solid evidence, but it can be so powerful in influencing a jury, especially in 1985. Now, the prosecution hammered on a supposed motive, which was lust and greed. They argued that Patty wanted to cash in on Bill's life insurance and just run off with a lover. They emphasized that she had recently paid up Bill's life insurance policy and implied that this was calculated, so we're capable of murder if we're just paying our bills. Now, they also suggested she was eager to be free of her marriage, and to back this, they paraded those witnesses who claimed Patty had made past remarks about wishing Bill dead or soliciting his murder. One man testified that Patty told him that she had considered shooting Bill in his sleep years prior. Another said she outright offered money for the deed, and these statements, if believed, are damning. But Patty's defense, however, would later argue that these stories were unreliable and in some instances, products of coercion or guilt. Recall that one man changed his story and another insisted any talk of murder was just in jest. Unfortunately for Patty, though, the jury heard the sensational claims more loudly than the rebuttals. Now, on the forensic side, the prosecution had surprisingly little. There were no eyewitnesses, no confession, no physical evidence directly proving that Patty pulled the trigger. In fact, they had to confront the awkward fact that Patty's GSR test was negative, meaning scientifically there was no residue indicating that she'd fired a gun that night. They also had to acknowledge Patty's own injuries, that she didn't just walk away scot-free from that night. The question hung, if she staged an elaborate scene, would she really strangle and cut herself with a knife deeply enough to leave lasting wounds? The state's narrative was that, yes, she would, that Patty inflicted the cuts on her neck and maybe even bruised herself to fake a rape scenario. And it's a theory that many found far-fetched, but the prosecutors really pushed it. They emphasized any inconsistencies in Patty's account of the night, for instance, whether she heard one thunderclap or two, or the exact sequence of her actions. Minor discrepancies, which are actually common when someone recounts a traumatic event, were portrayed as lies. But perhaps the most striking example of the prosecution's focus came when an investigator testified that Patty supposedly described herself as, quote, a woman with a hot sexual engine, end quote. This crude quote was presented as something Patty had said to explain her multiple affairs, basically painting her as this sexual deviant. But here's the thing, there was no record that Patty ever said those words. It wasn't in any police report or tape, and Patty flatly denied ever saying it. The defense protested that this alleged quote was unverified and likely fabricated. Nonetheless, the prosecution leaned on it, repeating hot sexual engine to the jury, clearly aiming to just scandalize them. It was character evidence of the most inflammatory kind, and it left an impression. Patty's defense team, led by attorney Robert Beard, tried to steer the focus back to the hard evidence or lack thereof, and they reminded the jury, look at the crime scene. There were genuine signs of an intruder. There were cut wires, a possibly poisoned dog, a neighbor who saw a strange car. They pointed out that Patty had no blood on her when she came for help, despite having supposedly shot her husband twice at close range, and that she was the one who ran half-dressed through the rain to get help, not exactly what you would expect if she had just carefully plotted a murder. They stressed that no murder weapon was found in Patty's possession. It was in a pond. And if she had truly tossed it there, why would she leave a single boot print on the bank? Wouldn't she have tried to hide her tracks better or, say, toss her boots in the pond too? The defense floated the idea that the boot print could have been made at any other time. Patty lived on that land, and her kids and she played around that pond often, or even by an officer. In fact, the initial officer on the scene admitted that the print wasn't noticed until days later, raising questions about when it happened. You guys, the forensics were just not conclusive. And Beard also highlighted investigative failures, the untouched breaker box and phone lines, the failure to collect potential hair evidence, and the dismissal of that flashlight sighting by the daughter. And these all suggested a rush to judgment. But when the defense tried to introduce these points, it often got lost in the salacious details of Patty's personal life being trotted out by the state. One thing the defense was not able to do was present an alternative suspect or detailed theory of who the intruder might have been. They could suggest it, but they had no name or motive to give the jury for if not Patty, then who, right? There was talk that Bill might have been digging into local drug dealers, which was a theory that Patty's children would later raise as a possible motive for an outsider to target him. However, no evidence of that was ever presented at trial. The unknown intruder remained a shadowy question mark, which may have made it hard for jurors to hang their doubt on. The trial lasted only about 4 days, and both sides gave closing arguments. The prosecutor doubled down, even invoking a sort of moral duty. He suggested that letting Patty go free would be a blow to the dignity of the institution of marriage, implicitly stating that a woman like her, who cheated and allegedly sought other lovers, deserved punishment. This kind of argument is really breathtaking. It's basically saying, convict her to uphold traditional values. And the sexism on display was blatant, something that has since drawn heavy criticism. Patty's attorney urged the jury to focus on facts, saying nothing was black and white and not to be swayed by moral condemnation. But it was an uphill battle. In April of 1985, the jury returned with a verdict, guilty of first-degree murder. Patty Prewitt was convicted and subsequently sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole for 50 years. That was the mandatory sentence for capital murder. Patty was only 36 years old. She would not even be eligible to seek parole until the year 2036, when she'd be 86 years old. Upon hearing the sentence, Patty was in disbelief. She maintained then, as she always had, that she did not kill Bill, but the courtroom's judgment was final. Some jurors later said that the combined weight of Patty's affairs and those men's testimonies about murder solicitations convinced them, even more than the physical evidence. In essence, they judged Patty's character, then presumed her guilt. It's a verdict that raises uncomfortable questions. Did Patty get convicted for who she was rather than what she did? Many have argued that sexism played a major role, that a man who cheated might not have been vilified in the same way or found guilty on such thin evidence. As one legal expert put it, Patty's trial was shockingly full of sexism and misogyny, with her sex life used to inflame the jury. Patty was sent to the Women's Eastern Reception Diagnostic and Correctional Center in Vandalia, Missouri, the state's prison for female inmates. Going from being a mother of five who had never been in serious trouble before to suddenly being a convicted murderer serving life was unimaginably hard. I can't even imagine it. Her children were devastated. They had just lost their dad, and now their mom was effectively gone too, locked away in a prison cell. Patty's oldest daughter, Jane, was just 16, and she had to suddenly take on a caretaker role for her younger siblings. The family home, once filled with both parents' love, was completely broken. Over the years, Patty missed every milestone, every one of her kids' high school graduations, their weddings, the birth of their many grandchildren, even the birth of a great-grandchild decades later. She missed everything, Jane would later say, trying to convey the enormity of it. Yet even as the Prewitt family struggled to adjust, they never abandoned Patty. All five children steadfastly believed in their mother's innocence. And at trial, some of the kids had even testified for her, saying that they truly thought someone else was in the house that night. Remember, two of them actually saw that light in the basement. The jury just didn't credit that, but the children themselves never wavered. Jane especially became Patty's rock. She visited her mom in prison regularly and later became the public face of efforts to free Patty. For Patty, prison could have been a place of despair. And of course, there were dark times. She later admitted that she learned the shower room was the best place to cry so no one could see. But Patty resolved early on that she would not be defined by her cell. If anything, she threw herself into self-improvement and helping others, perhaps as a way to find purpose in a situation that could easily breed hopelessness. Over the next 40 years, Patty Prewitt became something of a model inmate, though that term doesn't quite capture her journey. She pursued every educational opportunity available. She earned multiple college degrees behind bars, which is a remarkable feat in itself. She became a certified personal trainer and taught fitness classes to other prisoners. She got a job as a computer programming instructor for the prison. Yes, Patty learned to code and then taught other women valuable job skills in the field of technology. Fellow inmates looked up to Patty as a mentor and a mom figure. She often encouraged young prisoners to hold their heads up and make the most of their time, telling them that prison was just a stop and it didn't have to define them. And I just think that is so remarkable that she knew she was never going to get out, or she probably believed that, and yet she still persevered. Patty also tapped into her creative side. She was a founding member of the prison's theater group in Vandalia, part of the prison performing arts program. Incredibly, Patty wrote a play while incarcerated that was performed at the prestigious John F. Kennedy Center for the Performing Arts in Washington, D.C. She also became a published writer as well, contributing essays and poetry about her experiences. In short, Patty transformed herself from an inmate with a number, she was reportedly Missouri inmate number 85704, into a respected mentor, educator, and artist within the prison community. Her resilience earned her admiration far beyond the prison walls. Wardens, guards, and Missouri correction officials took note of her positive presence. All the while, though, Patty never stopped fighting to prove her innocence. In the late 1980s and 90s, her legal appeals wound their way through the courts, but without new evidence or clear errors to point to, the verdict and sentence were repeatedly upheld. The 1980s forensic science limitations were also a huge barrier. There was no DNA testing available at the time of her trial to potentially identify another man's DNA, for instance. And since the investigators had not preserved key physical evidence like the hair or fingerprints at the breaker, etc., there wasn't much new to test in later years. Patty's case largely sat dormant legally for a long time, but her family and friends kept the flame of hope alive. By the 2000s and 2010s, Patty's story started gaining more attention as a possible wrongful conviction. Advocacy groups like the Midwest Innocence Project and Missouri Cure, which is a prisoner rights organization, took interest in her case. Jane, Patty's daughter, tirelessly campaigned for her mom's freedom, writing letters, speaking to governors, rallying supporters. Journalists began digging into the details, and what they found was troubling. Evidence that had been ignored, sexist undertones in the trial, and an investigation that looked sloppy at best or biased at worst. Lawyers and lawmakers started to join the chorus, noting how exemplary a prisoner Patty was and how dubious some aspects of her conviction were. One former Missouri Department of Corrections director, George Lombardi, publicly endorsed Patty's release, which was an extraordinary step since prison officials rarely weighed into whether someone was wrongfully convicted. In 2018, after 40 years in corrections, Lombardi said he had never made a single recommendation for clemency until now, urging Missouri's governor to free Patty Pruitt. He effectively said keeping her locked up served no purpose and that he believed in her character and her claim of innocence. For decades, one major roadblock hindered efforts to exonerate Patty, which was the lack of preserved physical evidence from the crime scene that could be tested with modern forensic methods. Remember, this is a 1984 case. DNA profiling was not used in criminal cases yet. It wouldn't really start until the late 80s. And since the investigators back then were convinced that Patty was guilty, they didn't carefully save anything from the scene. In fact, for many years, everyone assumed that what little evidence had been collected was lost or destroyed. There were even rumors that some evidence might have been ruined in a flood at a storage facility. Then came a surprising break. In the late 2010s, as the Midwest Innocence Project was reviewing Patty's case, it came to light that some evidence had actually been preserved in storage, untouched for decades. It hadn't been destroyed after all. It was essentially just forgotten about in a box. But this discovery was huge. Among the items were Patty's nightgown or pajamas from that night, stained and potentially containing DNA from the attacker. The cut telephone cords were in there, and other crime scene materials. Also, evidence from Patty's sexual assault exam, which, though not done immediately, was apparently done at some point, existed in the form of swabs. In other words, there was now a real chance to apply modern DNA testing to this 1984 case. If DNA from an unknown male, not Bill and not Patty, was found on Patty's body or clothes, it would powerfully back up her intruder story. It could even identify the perpetrator if his profile was in any kind of database. So in 2018, Patty's legal team filed a motion for post-conviction DNA testing under Missouri's updated statutes that allow for such testing on old cases. However, the state fought against it. The local prosecutor argued technicalities, that the evidence had not been stored with DNA in mind, meaning there could be contamination or degradation, and that regardless, Patty wasn't convicted on DNA evidence, so DNA now shouldn't matter. It's a bit of a paradox. You convict someone without DNA, then when DNA could potentially prove them innocent, you say, well, we didn't need DNA to prove guilt, so we don't need it to question that guilt. Patty's lawyers and supporters found this stance infuriating. Of course, what would it hurt? What are they hiding? Why not just test it? If it proved nothing, so be it. But if it showed another man's DNA intertwined with the crime, then that's everything. And you should want to, as a prosecutor, find justice. After all, isn't that your job? Two of Patty's children even submitted affidavits reminding the court that they saw someone else in the house that night through the flashlight under the door. And the defense pointed to that neighbor who saw a mystery car and, of course, the poisoned dogs, evidence of an outside plot. The implication was that DNA testing could tie these clues together and finally reveal the truth. By 2019, the case caught the attention of local media in a big way. The Kansas City Star ran opinion pieces and TV news covered Patty's fight for DNA testing. It became part of a larger conversation about innocence and the challenges of older cases. Missouri's Western District Court of Appeals ultimately denied Patty's request for DNA testing in 2019 on procedural grounds. It was a devastating blow. Essentially, the court said that even if DNA was found, it might not conclusively prove her innocence in light of other evidence, and thus they wouldn't allow testing. To Patty's family and supporters, this felt like the system slamming a door on the truth. DNA evidence has exonerated hundreds of people nationwide, often overriding circumstantial cases like Patty's, but here they wouldn't even look. Faced with legal dead ends, Patty's team turned increasingly towards clemency as her last hope. Clemency is not about proving innocence, it's about mercy and correcting injustices outside the courts. By 2021 to 2022, Patty had been in prison over 36 years. She was one of the longest-serving female prisoners in Missouri and certainly one of the oldest at 70-something at the time. Her case had garnered sympathetic attention. In 2022, the podcast Wrongful Conviction with Maggie Freeling did an episode on Patty explicitly asking, did sexism put her behind bars? That added to the public outcry. Articles on Yahoo News and People Magazine highlighted how biased the investigation and trial appeared and how Patty had refused to take a plea deal of just 7 years because she insisted on her innocence. Now think about that. Patty could have been out by the early 90s if she had just falsely confessed, but she chose to gamble on the truth and lost, resulting in a life sentence. It speaks to her stubborn integrity or perhaps faith in a justice system that ultimately failed her. By 2023, pressure was mounting on Missouri's Governor Mike Parson to act. Parson, who was a former sheriff, was not known for being particularly soft on crime, but he had granted some high-profile clemencies. Patty supporters launched the hashtag Free Patty Pruitt campaign, and lawmakers from both political parties in Missouri wrote letters on Patty's behalf. And perhaps most poignantly, all of Patty's children and grandchildren, now grown, pleaded for their mother's release. They had lived their entire lives with her in prison, and they just wanted her home. Finally, on December 20th of 2024, you guys, this was like 3 months ago, just 5 days before Christmas, the news came. Missouri Governor Mike Parson granted clemency to Patty Pruitt, commuting her sentence to time served. It wasn't just exoneration. The murder conviction technically still stands. Clemency is just an act of mercy. It's not a reversal of verdict. But the commutation meant that Patty's life sentence was cut short and she would be released immediately after nearly 38 and a half years in custody. For Patty, it was surreal, a moment that she had fought for and dreamed of for all those years. The day clemency was announced, Patty was, according to her family, given only about 2 hours' notice that she was getting out. One moment, she was an inmate attending a routine visitation with her daughter, and the next, prison officials were telling her to pack up her stuff. She was going home that day. In fact, it happened so fast that Patty walked out of Vandalia Prison in her prison uniform, carrying her belongings in trash bags, hardly believing that she was free. Outside waiting to meet her were her children and now grandchildren who had never seen their grandma outside of a prison visiting room. Jane and her siblings called it a Christmas miracle. After so many denied appeals and unanswered pleas, their mother was finally coming home. Patty was 75 years old. A photo taken that day shows Patty beaming, arms raised in joy, standing next to a sign that coincidentally and almost poetically flashed the words "early release December 20th. After nearly four decades behind bars, Patty Prewitt received an unexpected early release on December 20th of 2024, a commutation from the governor that allowed her to reunite with her family. Having her sentence commuted does not erase the conviction, and Patty technically remains a convicted murderer just in the eyes of the law, but clemency gave her her life back. Her supporters, while overjoyed, note that justice is bittersweet. Patty regained freedom, but so much was lost that can never be returned, including Bill's life and all those years of family moments. So Patty's case leaves us with a lot to think about. First, it highlights how the character of a defendant, especially a woman, can unduly sway a trial. The prosecution in 1985 could not physically tie Patty to the murder, so they tied her to a moral failing and then just relied on that. They played to a jury's potential biases about how a good wife and mother should behave. This is a broader systemic issue. Women defendants sometimes face a sort of double standard where evidence against them is their divergence from social norms. In Patty's trial, phrases like sleazy affairs and attacks on her motherhood were used to effectively put her morality on trial. As one article later put it, quote, "No woman should face that kind of treatment from our legal system," end quote. The lesson here is that justice should be based on facts, not judgment of character. Juries and investigators alike must be cautious not to let personal biases, like disapproval of someone's personal life, override objective analysis. And I must add that while I do agree with all of this, I don't agree that it would apply to Casey Anthony's case. Because as much as there wasn't really physical evidence to apply to Casey Anthony, her behavior was very telling. So she's an exception to this rule, okay? Now, second, the Patty Prewitt story shows the limitations of 1980s forensic and investigative standards. Today, a crime like this would involve extensive DNA swabbing, professional crime scene preservation, and likely a very different outcome. But back then, there was no DNA testing, and crucial evidence wasn't saved. The tunnel vision that set in early meant leads were dropped, fingerprints weren't taken, the hair wasn't collected, because the cops thought they already knew the answer. And this is a common cause of wrongful convictions. Once police lock onto a theory, often that the spouse did it, they may unintentionally ignore or even destroy evidence that doesn't fit that theory. In Patty's case, that tunnel vision arguably cost her decades of freedom. Only much later did a court even consider testing the evidence that remained, and even then, it was a struggle. And then finally, there's the issue of prosecutorial resistance to revisit old convictions. Even when new technology like DNA or new witnesses emerge, some prosecutors fight testing or re-examining cases, as we saw here. And it raises the question, is the system more interested in just maintaining a conviction than ensuring that the right person was convicted? Patty's prosecutor famously said Patty was convicted on motive and opportunity, and that DNA wouldn't necessarily change that. But that mindset is troubling because it implies that once someone is found guilty, proving their innocence later is not a priority. Patty Prewitt is home now, adjusting to a world that changed enormously while she was incarcerated. And she jokes about how she has to learn how to use seatbelts and smartphones. She spends her time with her children and meets grandchildren that she'd only seen through plexiglass windows. And at 75, she's carrying on with the same resilience she showed in prison, advocating for others, appreciating the small things like a soft bed or a walk outside whenever she wants. She has said she forgives those who wronged her, but she also continues to proclaim her innocence and hopes that someday her name can be fully cleared. Whether the state ever officially exonerates her remains to be seen. In the end, Patty Prewitt is free. free to hug her kids, free to sit on her porch in the sunshine, free to sleep in a bed that's not a prison bunk. And after everything, she remains hopeful. As Patty herself said soon after her release, she said, "I have children. I could never give up." Her story, painful as it is also one of hope and strength and a cautionary tale from which we all can learn. Thank you so much for listening to today's story on Patty Pruitt, and we will see you again next week on Mama Mystery. Mama Mystery out. Bye.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Do you ever think about switching insurance companies to see if you could save some cash? Progressive makes it easy to see if you could save when you bundle your home and auto policies. Try it at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Potential savings will vary. Not available in all states.
You can have it all. Great pay, awesome benefits, a flexible schedule, the chance to grow. At Cox, we're recruiting auto and diesel technicians to join our Manheim and Fleet Services teams. If you're ready for a new job and want to experience an award-winning workplace, drive your career forward with us. Visit cox.career/autotech to learn more. That's cox.career/autotech.